Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all in the court. But we're especially delighted to see Parkview High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming today. You may be seated. The Parkview High School students were here along with students from other high schools today as part of the Court with Class program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they come, they've been sent materials about this case. They may engage in some activities relating to this case. They come and listen to an oral argument, and in addition to that, they will also have heard at lunch a discussion with a justice of this court. And the Parkview students were here and participated in a discussion with Justice Bradley. The discussion related to the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of this case or any other case heard today. If any of you would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, you raise your hand, the Deputy Marshal will give you a summary. It's easy to understand and listen to the case if you know something about it. All right, let me introduce the members of the court to you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, I'm the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley met with the students and others during lunch. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to Justice Crooks's left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call the last case for today, 09AP524, Metropolitan Associates versus City of Milwaukee. Arguing on behalf of the Metropolitan Associates is Robert L. Gordon. Mr. Gordon, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and members of the court. Madam Chief Justice and members of the court, it has been 9 years since I had the privilege of standing at this podium and arguing the Nankin case. And as much as I do not want to abuse the honor of returning to this podium by simply repeating everything I said to this court 9 years ago, my concern is that is exactly what I will end up doing today, since everything this court stated emphatically in Nankin in finding the prior version of Section 7437 unconstitutional fully applies to what this legislature has tried to do now in response to Nankin. In Nankin, this court emphatically stated that a two-track appeal system for property tax assessments, where some citizens get only a judicial review of an administrative hearing conducted by untrained members of a Board of Review, while other citizens get to discard the Board of Review record and start all over again with a full-blown circuit trial in front of a trained circuit court judge, cannot be tolerated under the Equal Protection Clause. This court made it clear in Nankin what the legislature could do and what it could not do in response. Clearly, after Nankin, the legislature could simply have repealed Section 7437 altogether and left no one eligible to invoke it in any town or city or village. Or the legislature could have done nothing and left things just as this court left them in Nankin.
Mr. Gordon, I want to challenge what you just said. Would that be true if there were a right to a jury trial?
That the statute could have been repealed?
Yeah.
For a fundamental right to a jury, I don't necessarily think that that's the case. If there were a fundamental right to a jury, which, of course, this court has not decided and is not directly before this court, I think if it's a fundamental right, then yes, there would have to be some provision for everyone to challenge your tax assessments.
Well, is there a right?
We think there is. And we think that under the under the village food test, we cited cases in our brief going back to the 19th century where historically people had been filing refunds for property taxes and getting them and had a jury, whereas in the historic certiorari proceeding, there was no jury. So our belief, as we stated in our brief, is that there is a right to a jury trial in a case seeking a refund of property tax. Vis-a-vis this case, we don't think that it aids the city either way, whether there is or is not a right to a jury trial. Because our position is if indeed the right to a jury trial is there and that was not briefed or argued or considered in the Nankin case, it doesn't help the city because that's yet another example of a significant difference between the former and current statutes, between a 7437 action and a certiorari procedure that this court didn't consider. So it's another notch in finding things significantly different.
And then let me agree with you
okay.
for a minute. If you win this case, is the legislature going to come along and take away all right to a separate de novo trial and just have a certiorari review?
But for the jury trial issue, which may end up in this court in that context, yes, they can. I think they could have after Nankin. Certainly, we understand that one outflow of this case, if we prevail, may well be the legislature determining that 7437 should be repealed. But, of course, Justice Prosser, they could have done that in this current legislation. They enacted several new provisions, which we claim did not sufficiently bridge the gap of significant difference, as this court found in Nankin, and we'll go through this as time permits this afternoon. But the legislature did not logically, if the legislature was so convinced that the new procedures it was creating were so truly made the procedures constitutionally equivalent to a refund action under 7437, then logically the legislature would have at that point repealed section 7437 as entirely superfluous and make the new procedures exclusive for everyone. Clearly, the legislature must have believed that these new procedures remain significantly different from 7437 since they chose to leave them in place. But yes, the obvious answer to your question, Justice Prosser, is of course the legislature can at any time, before or after this case is decided, but for the jury trial issue that you raised, could repeal 7437 altogether, and we have no equal protection claim. Indeed, after Nankin, that's precisely what they could have done. They could have repealed it, they could have left it in place, or they could have done a number of other things and left.
Okay. Your opposing counsel seems to suggest that really changes have been made in the procedure that basically eliminate the differences, that they're pretty close together now. Why, if that is true, why is it that the city is so anxious to sustain this new legislation?
Well, I think our position is that they really don't do it, and that's a question I think for the city's council. Our position is certainly it doesn't bridge that gap, and that's one of the reasons why the city lobbied for enactment of these new changes, and the city is up here taking this case now to a third level, or we took it to the third level, as we had to. But the city certainly, I think that one can imply from the city's vigorous defense of the statute that they don't think it's the same. Because once again, if it were the same, there's no reason to. If they were truly the same, we wouldn't be here. We think they're not the same. We think that what the legislature did was very cosmetic, and we can go through these, and did not leave anyone any differently situated than they were when Nankin was first decided. These don't help people with respect to the differences between certiorari appeals and 7437 and between Board of Review hearings. and 7437. And maybe to fully respond to your question, I can get into those issues of exactly why the legislation hasn't done that. And keep in mind that this court in Nankin really went through two decision processes. One was to compare certiorari appeals to the certiorari appeals of board review hearings to 7437 actions. The other was to take board review hearings themselves and compare them to 7437 actions. And in both cases, the court held very clearly that these were significantly different. Now, let me, if I can, turn to the first issue that the court considered, which is the differences between certiorari appeals and 7437.
Oh, just before you do that, I'm sorry.
Sure.
But isn't everybody in this state treated the same under this statute?
No, they're not, because this kind of gets into a rational basis argument, but no, they're not treated the same in the sense that in Nankin, this court firmly determined that there was no rational basis for drawing, and the court drew from the Milwaukee Brewers case, drawing a line of demarcation at the Milwaukee County border.
But in Nankin, only Milwaukee County had a different procedure.
Correct.
Here, the whole state has the same procedure, doesn't it?
The whole state has the same procedure, but from the point of view of individual taxpayers, if I live in a community that happens, for whatever reason, to enact an ordinance, why should I be treated any differently than someone
So the thing provides the unequal treatment here is the opt-in or opt-out provision.
Correct, because it's totally, municipalities can do it for any reason they want. There's no logical reason, and certainly if we got into a rational basis discussion, what possible reason could there be for dividing people based on their due process rights to appeal their tax assessments based on the serendipity, if you will, of whether they live in a community that happened to enact an ordinance or not. That's what any rational basis argument, Madam Chief Justice, would have to come down to describing and articulating, which the city hasn't tried to do, and the Court of Appeals never got into that issue because they decided on the threshold issue.
What was the threshold issue?
The threshold issue was significantly different.
Pardon me?
The threshold issue was that the Court of Appeals determined that the statutes are no longer significantly different. Therefore, under Milwaukee Brewers, the Court of Appeals did not need to consider whether there was a rational basis.
Well, your discussion challenges almost every opt-in or opt-out statute there is.
No, because I think the predicate, Justice Abrahamson, is that there is some equal protection violation inherent to begin with.
Well, clearly, if there's an opt-in or out, there's a difference in the two. Otherwise, you wouldn't give anybody a chance to make a choice.
Correct, okay. But we're dealing with, once again, we're dealing with what this court has previously already determined, at the threshold issue of significant difference, that the procedures are, as this court has already determined, so significantly different that we had to get to a rational basis. And I think to get to a rational basis in that situation, I don't think this necessarily puts at risk every opt-in or opt-out statute, but I think it certainly puts at risk this one because of the significant difference and the fact that there is no logical basis to distinguish between rights of taxpayers based on whether their municipality happened to enact an ordinance and happened not to.
Counsel, how would you ask this court to address the issue of right to jury trial within this context?
I don't think it's necessary for the court to decide that issue.
Is it possible you don't think it's necessary because you think there's such a significant difference between the de novo review and the enhanced certiorari review, even in combination with the enhanced board of review method?
I think that's true, Justice Gableman. We believe that based on what this court already held in Nankin and our belief that each of the individual items do not satisfy that.
But let's say someone else took a contrary view. Wouldn't the right to a jury trial be a significant difference?
I think so. I think it would be. I think that I think we would prefer the court to consider and decide that issue if it chooses, as part of the determination of whether there is of how far we're going down the road of significant difference. If there is a right to a jury trial, it is an additional significant difference added on that, in essence, piles onto our case. If I can be a little colloquial, but we would prefer the court to decide it, but we're not. We don't believe it's fully necessary to decide the case, but we certainly would welcome. We would all welcome, in practice, as we've mentioned, anecdotally in practice, jury trials are demanded, and these cases have juries. But the issue has never been come up except in one circuit court decision that we mentioned in our brief involving Milwaukee, that circuit judge in Milwaukee decided a jury was available, and the city did not appeal it. So there's been no appellate decision, and certainly if the court deems that necessary to decide the significant difference issue, it's certainly an issue that we would welcome a ruling on.
Counsel, in your brief, you have two paragraphs on that issue. And I didn't know what to do with those two paragraphs that address that issue. I looked at the Court of Appeals opinion, and in footnote 9 of the Court of Appeals opinion, excuse me, it says, Metropolitan Associates does not contend either that it or any similarly situated taxpayer would have a right to a jury trial under 7437(3)(d) or that this would affect the constitutionality of the challenge provision of 2007 WIS Act 86. And when I read your two paragraphs, when this kind of an issue comes before us for which there is no prior case law that has addressed it, I'm used to the whole case centering around that issue. I'm used to that issue being argued and briefed by more than two passing paragraphs, and we have all sorts of references to Blackstone's commentary on English law because, of course, you know what the test is. Do you think that by briefing it in two paragraphs, you've met the test to establish a right to a jury trial?
No, I have not, and I concede certainly, Justice Bradley, as anyone can see by opening the briefs and seeing what's in there, we did not specifically argue that point. We chose to address it because the Court of Appeals had mentioned it, had addressed it, and raised it. We mentioned it in passing, as it will. We did not specifically, and that's why I kind of hedged a bit, if I will, to Justice Gableman's question, because in fairness, we did not fully brief the issue, nor did the city fully brief the issue.
No, I looked at their brief, and that directly addresses the issue. I found on page 14 of their brief one paragraph that tangentially, and then one sentence that does address it.
Yeah. Well, no, the issue has not been briefed to this court, and I that's why I was hesitant in asking just in to respond to Justice Gableman's question to say let's go full tilt and decide it, because we obviously did not make it a specific argument in our brief, nor did the city. We just, I think both sides decided to respond at least to what the Court of Appeals has raised.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you. Did you say let's go full tilt and decide it?
No.
Let's not go full
tilt. I would like the court to decide it, but in fairness, we did not brief it, and so I cannot ask the court to decide it as I could stand here on an issue that we would traditionally and the city would have traditionally fully briefed. Now, if we can come back to the significant differences issue, which is the one issue before the court, if we start with the difference between certiorari appeals and 7437 actions, this court clearly held in paragraph 24 of Nankin that the fundamental difference between them is that a certiorari review is, and I'm quoting from paragraph 24, simply another means of judicial review of an administrative hearing, while a 7437 action is a full-blown civil action which proceeds as if the administrative hearing never occurred. Now, while the legislature slightly changed certiorari procedures in Act 86 by slightly expanding what the circuit court could consider, In doing so, the legislature also specifically added words to the statute that said that whatever additional materials the court might consider, the certiorari court still had to make its decision based on the record before the Board of Review, as possibly supplemented by that additional material. And we submit that by using those nine words in the statute, based on the record before the Board of Review, the legislature really did not change what this court had held in Nankin, since a certiorari review, which must be based on the record before the board, is still necessarily simply another means of judicial review, and that's exactly what this court said in Nankin, makes it inherently significantly different from a 7437 action as a matter of constitutional law. Now, the legislature did give a certiorari court permission to consider three possible items to supplement the board review record, but significantly, we think, it did not require the court to consider any of them. Now, these three permissive items are evidence that was unavailable at the time of the board hearing, evidence the board would not admit, and then there's a completely undefined catch-all for evidence the court otherwise determines should be considered. Now, the Court of Appeals concluded that these few changes made certiorari review functionally equivalent to a full trial on the merits, but we submit that in the arena in which these cases are actually tried, that's not the case at all. And the way we try, and we can demonstrate that best to the court, is through the example we used in our brief, which is a complex commercial case in which two parties have expert witnesses which are far apart in value. Now, as this court is aware from its detailed discussion of assessment methodology in the Adams Outdoor Advertising case a few years ago, tax assessment cases are valuation cases which are entirely driven by competing expert testimony. One of the things that Act 86 certainly didn't change is the fundamental rule that expert witness credibility determinations made by the trier of fact are uniquely within the province of a fact finder and can't be second-guessed by anyone on appeal. This court cited that familiar universal rule in Adams. So it's critical to properly trying any assessment case that the trier of fact completely understands how expert testimony and expert credibility are to be properly evaluated. Now, if we can, let's take an example, which is what we alluded to in our brief. We have a large commercial building or shopping center or corporate headquarters. The parties are literally $50 million, let's say, apart. And there are cases where parties are that far apart on valuation. So we'll have two experts, and let's just pick numbers and say one expert values the property at, say, $70 million. The other values the property at $120 million. Now, clearly, if these experts are following all the prepper methodology that this court described in detail in Adams, it's going to take quite a lot of explanation for each expert to explain persuasively how he or she ended up $50 million higher or lower than another qualified expert. And so we can expect detailed, lengthy reports and detailed testimony. But when the case is tried in the first instance to the Board of Review, which is legally untrained, they have no training in evaluating complex testimony. They don't understand how evidence rules should be used to keep testimony in and out for experts, and they will not have studied Adams to know how methodology is to be applied. So this untrained lay board will hear two experts try to persuade the board that why they are better and why the other side's being $50 million apart is not as good as theirs. The board then makes a credibility determination that could be based on anything, or indeed could be based on nothing, and that board will never have to explain that credibility determination to anyone in any written or oral decision.
Sounds like a jury.
No, but, Your Honor, I think the critical difference is that juries do not sit by themselves. They sit in a courtroom with specific jury instructions under the guidance of a trained circuit judge who, A, makes sure that the jury understands what they're supposed to do, B, makes evidentiary decisions so that if the experts are going way out of field, if the experts are saying things that a jury shouldn't hear, that circuit judge is there to stop them. So I don't think that the analogy to a jury trial is correct because there's no gatekeeper there. They're on their own. Now, in this case, in a jurisdiction where 7437 is still fully applicable, the taxpayer can file a civil action in circuit court and start all over again with a trained circuit judge. But in a jurisdiction like Milwaukee, where 7437 has been taken away, that taxpayer gets no relief at all because Act 86 once again says the circuit judge has to decide the case based on the Board of Review records. And if the Board of Review has made a credibility determination, even if there's no rational basis for it, the circuit judge is bound as a matter of law from from rethinking that, and so the credibility determination goes all the way. Now, in the few minutes I have left, let me try to really briefly address
this. Mr. Gordon, the argument would be made that if there was a $50 million case, the circuit judge would just simply call in those experts again.
But that's a very good question, because I think the question is, there's several answers to that. One, the statute does not require the circuit judge to do anything. The statute says the circuit court may do three things, including that third catch-all. I think I think that the amicus brief of the state bar tax section alluded to this, that the city has indicated, I think on page 15 of their brief, that they would be, if a case has been fully tried to the board of review and both experts have testified, the city has, the suggestion in the brief is that the city would oppose any additional testimony. So what we still have a significant difference in this situation, Justice Prosser, because on one hand, in a 7437 action, as long as evidence is admissible, it comes in. If it's admissible, if it's not privileged, it can come in. In this situation, we have a judge who may be allowed to take other testimony, but a city can oppose it simply because they say, they already testified, we don't want it to come in. And so we think that's still a very significant difference, is that under 7437, as a matter of right, you can put on your case. If evidence is admissible, it comes in. The city or town can't oppose the testimony coming in by saying, we just don't want to hear it. Here, they can say that. They can say, no, we don't want to hear it. And that, I think, is still significantly different. It's a discretionary thing. The circuit judge may consider it, but if the city opposes it, or if the judge says, you guys already had this battle in the Board of Review, they made a credibility determination, I'm not mixing in. And here's the law that says I shouldn't mix in. So I think they're still significantly different.
Counsel, aren't there also differences in discovery and your right to discovery in
absolutely.
The circuit court action?
Absolutely. And that's in the seconds I probably have left here, we have addressed that in our brief, but the discovery in the Board of Review situation is only what they've allowed is a chance to exchange exhibits 10 days before trial. So you're exchanging actual exhibits that the other side wants to use. And as you, Justice Ziegler, and everyone else on the court who's been a trial judge knows, the way discovery works in real life is you can discover things that the other side doesn't want you to see, and far enough in advance of trial for those to allow you to make meaningful trial decisions and to use that to your advantage. I see my light has gone on, so.
May finish your thought, counsel.
Okay, I will finish the thought that I would refer the court briefly to the, I would ask the court to think about the Adams and Walgreens decisions. Complex cases this court decided that came up on clean records under Section 7437, and asked the court to hypothesize how different those cases would have looked to this court if they came up on very untidy records that have been made in an hour before a board of review instead of with 2 and 3 day trials in front of experienced circuit judges. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Vincent Moschella from the Office of the City Attorney in Milwaukee, representing the City of Milwaukee. Counsel.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Vince Moschella. I'm a deputy city attorney. I'm here on behalf of City Attorney Grant Langley for the City of Milwaukee to defend Act 86 on behalf of the city and other municipalities in the state. If there's one thing that I would like to emphasize to you from the get-go, I believe this case turns on the burden of proof. And it turns on the burden of proof at two levels, both at the constitutional level, where we are at here in this court, and then by connection at the trial court on what the legislature has done to the burden of proof in the trial court. Now, at the constitutional level, we started out here. Back in the Nankin days, we had certiorari. And you're all familiar with the four elements of certiorari. I'm not going to repeat them. And then we have a de novo trial, same as in any other civil case. What the new legislation does is close that gap so that the rights that are afforded to a taxpayer under the new statute under in a municipality that adopts the provisions of Act 86, they now get rights that the legislature has deemed sufficient to protect their interests in taxpayers, as taxpayers, in not being wrongly deprived of their hard-earned money. And we're sensitive to that. Remember, my boss is elected. All the taxpayers in the city are represented here. And we want to be sure that there's something fair, because we as government officials understand that if the process is not deemed fair on the outside, we're all in big trouble. But to go back to it, once the standard is significantly different. And significant means getting it into a zone where the differences, while they do exist, and I'm not going to sit here and or stand here and misrepresent to you that you have two different processes. But in the real world that we operate in at the trial level, these cases are about valuation, and I should say also at the Board of Review. And the Board of Review certainly has some degree of expertise in the valuation of property. You're all familiar with the three-tier level of analysis. And the primary evidence that a trial court sees, or a Board of Review prior to that sees, most of the time, particularly in the commercial cases that are brought to us by plaintiffs such as Metropolitan Associates, these are appraisal reports. And many of the circuit judges will say, give me your report a week ahead of time. I'm going to take it home and read it. I don't want somebody sitting here going through six different comparable sales and telling me that the area is this close or that far. I'll take a look at it. I may have some questions for the appraisers, the experts on both sides. Counsel, if you want to ask a few questions, fine. And that's essentially how it is. Now, that's the same thing that happens at the board. And the big change here, and I think Judge Fine got it exactly right in his decision, is that for the first time in 160 years almost, in this state, tie doesn't go to the government in a tax case. And that's the old rule under certiorari, right? If the evidence is even roughly equal, and even sometimes a little less for the city, most of the time the city is going to win if there's at least something there for the court to lock onto. And so that's the big change the court has made, and Judge Fine got it right when he said once you produce some minimal evidence to rebut that presumption of validity that the city's assessment has, as soon as that's in there, now the court can decide it as stated in both sub 13 and sub 16 in the statutes without regard to what the board did. And I think also I'd like to say that in regard to Nankin, you gave us a roadmap. And you pointed out the defects between a distinction based solely on population or the Milwaukee County line and said, these are the problems we see with it. The legislature came in and said, okay, we're going to correct that. And I would submit to you that what they did was bring it into that zone where the petitioner here cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this is unconstitutional. There's enough rights there. It gives a fair fight to the taxpayer for the first time, and we're as concerned about that as the other side, because it's the legitimacy of our government. We're serious about that. Now, I noticed that you had a number of questions for my colleague about the jury trial issue, and I would like to touch on that, if I may. You have, I believe the petitioner provided to you as an appendix to their brief copy of a circuit court decision that the city chose not to appeal. There wasn't enough, let's just say the cost benefit wasn't there for the city. And the city's view of the law in regard to a jury trial in a 7437 case is as follows. At the time of the adoption of the state constitution, if a taxpayer felt he or she it had been overtaxed by the state, the proper way to get their money back was to bring an action in the circuit court for a return of money wrongly held. And that was a generic common law action. It applied in many areas as well as to tax refunds. It was just applied specifically in that area by aggrieved taxpayers. It's our view that once the legislature steps in and creates a statutory process, that generic use of the action for return of money goes out the door in favor of the legislative process. So we very firmly believe there is no right to a jury trial, and absent that right, then your decision shouldn't be affected by the absence or presence of it. It's just, it's not there for us.
I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that the legislature has the right to transform a procedure where someone has a jury trial right into one where it doesn't have a jury trial right?
In the case of taxation, which of course all flows from the legislature itself, in 1846, you did not have this involved statutory procedure. The only part of the procedure that's in front of you that a taxpayer had in 1846 was the so-called Board of Equalization, which has now evolved over time to the Board of Review. The Board of Equalization was your fellow farmers got together once a year and said that that 5 acres over there isn't really what our assessor said it was worth. If you felt that was wrong, you didn't have a statutory appeal the way you do under 7437. You didn't have it you didn't have a certiorari action. You had this action for the return of money, and it's generic, okay, across the board. It wasn't something where there was a statute or the action for the return of money applied solely to return of tax funds. It applies to everything. And we think here that by creating an entirely different statutory mechanism, that there is little, if anything, lost, particularly, and I want to emphasize this point, because of the change I described earlier that Judge Fine noted so well, that you get a new trier of fact when you go to the circuit court. You didn't before. It was a true cert review where the circuit court was kind of stuck with the decision of the Board of Review if there was anything there to support it. Now you get a new trier of fact. So legislature's saying, that's okay.
Is it truly that different, counsel? I mean, isn't it accurate to say that in the de novo action, the taxpayer must still post the disputed amount and seek the recovery of the difference?
They have to pay the tax, yes.
And then seek, by de novo review or certiorari, the return of the difference between that which the taxpayer claims is due and that which the government claims is due.
That is correct.
I am at a loss here, and I need your help and probably your opposing counsel's help. As I indicated in my questioning of opposing counsel, I want to be kind, very little in either of your briefs addressing this issue. This issue being whether or not there's a right to jury trial, that it existed at common law, or whether it was known or recognized at common law. There's a two-part test. The first prong of the test is whether the party has a right to have a statutory claim tried to a jury if the cause of action created by the statute existed, was known to, or recognized at common law at the time of the adoption of the Wisconsin Constitution in 1848. That's the first prong. Now, my problem is this. You started out with saying, hey, there's a high burden in this type of case. And there is. To declare a statute unconstitutional is a big deal. And therefore, the burden is to show that it's unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Not just a little bit, but beyond a reasonable doubt. And it seems like the focus in this case, in large part, is there a substantial difference? That's what we're all fighting about. These differences, are they a substantial difference? Or is it rather significantly different? I'm sorry. Which term is right, substantial or significant?
Significant.
Significantly different. So that's a continuum. You just continuum. You can say, well, it's sort of different, or it's quite a bit different, or is it significantly different beyond a reasonable doubt? That's tough. That's big stuff. One of the things that might make a difference in my analysis is if one group has a right to a jury trial and the other group doesn't. That could be a significant difference. But you know what? I don't know if one group has a right to a jury trial or the other doesn't, because it hasn't been really briefed or argued. And so what part, if any, does that question, the right to a jury trial, should it play in this analysis, in my analysis? If there is a right, it could be it could play a significant part in my determination of whether there is a significant difference.
Well, I understand your point completely, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. And so what do I do?
For the reasons previously stated, without being redundant, we don't think there is. And what I would ask the court to do is go up to 40,000 feet and look down. And when you look down, the process that you see that was there in 1846 or 48 and the process that you see in 2010 is entirely different.
And where is that set forth in your brief? What cases are you relying on?
There aren't any, to be honest. There isn't on this subject matter of what you did. Mm-hmm. You have a few cases that generically talk about the action for return of money. There's nothing that goes to it in this thing beyond what I believe Mr. Gordon put in his.
And did he have anything in his brief about what was going on in 1848 that you read?
Not aware of it.
In other words, you can't see anything from 40,000 feet up.
Well, I think there is some level where you have to make a distinction between and ask the question, what's the taxpayer getting? What's the municipality getting? Is this entire process, does everybody get a fair shake? Do they get to get their evidence in? Do they get to make all the arguments that are necessary to so that they can come away from the process feeling that they've been given a fair shake?
Well, let me ask you, if one side could get a jury trial and the other side couldn't, is that a, I will not use a term of art, is that a big deal?
In the same case? I'm not sure I understand your question.
One neighbor, okay, I'll make it more clear.
Yes,
if
please.
One, we've got two groups here, and no one disputes that the first part of this test as to constitutionality, that there are two separate groups. Both parties argue and you concede that. The next step is whether or not there's a significant difference. If one group has a right to a jury trial and the other group does
in
not.
In that context, though.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think that that's a significant difference?
I think the answer is yes, but I ask you to take a look at, again, the process. In terms of it being concretely established that at the time the state was founded, you had a taxation system that contemplated what we do in the 21st century that gave a jury trial versus now, and the legislature saying, look, there's a lot of reasons, and I guess I'd like to address one of the other questions that kind of dovetails in here. You said, why? Why do we want this? Well, you remember, this is the assessment process, part of the budgeting process, okay? And the assessments are sent out in late April, early May. Board of Review convenes in May. Most of the time, in most jurisdictions, Board of Review gets done in time for the city to make its, or the municipality to make its budget. In Milwaukee, of course, it takes longer because we have literally so many thousands of appeals. When you have thousands of appeals pending, what you want to try to do, at least from our perspective, is get them done quicker, force the plaintiff side to, or the taxpayer side to come clean on why they feel they were wronged, so that maybe we can sit down and talk about it. Maybe there's additional information. Sometimes we don't always get that information in a timely fashion. So what we'd like to do is have something that moves a little quicker and is a little more certain. And as you know, in the statutes, these actions are to be given preference once they go from the Board of Review over to the Circuit Court. So, again, that goes to rational basis, and I'm not sure we need to go there. But the legislature has decided, look, for purposes of doing business, to get back to your question, for purposes of doing business, we need some certainty, we need it sooner, we need it faster, we want more of these things to settle on the steps of City Hall and not on the steps of the courthouse. And for that reason, under home rule, they've given us the chance, and I think that's something you have to factor in here a bit too. Home rule is somewhat important. I think someone earlier alluded to the fact that why not? There are a lot of opt-in, opt-out statutes. And as long as the choices protect the critical elements for the taxpayer and the city, I think that you have a fair process and one that doesn't violate the Constitution.
And set aside the issue of whether there's a right to a jury trial?
In my mind, I don't think there is.
I understand that.
Because of the change that occurred, because the process this year and the process then are different.
Your response leads me to my next question. Don't you think that's a relatively significant factor to at least consider before you ask this court to uphold a statutory scheme which could conceivably be taking away the right to a jury trial?
Yes, but my answer is what it is. Yes.
Counsel, as a practical matter, help me out here. You've obviously thought about this issue. You had a good answer as to why you come out the way you do on the jury trial issue. Opposing counsel thinks there is the right to a jury trial, articulated that, even though it was succinct, it was articulated. It's something that came up at the Court of Appeals. If you were given the chance to brief it, would you basically write down the things that you've just said here today?
I'm not sure there's anything to add out there in the universe of resources that are available to us. I've been to the law library and looked in the constitutional archives. Perhaps your researchers are better than me and you can find something, but
it didn't seem
to be a lot there.
I got the impression you weren't winging it, that you'd actually thought through this and you had a reasoned answer for why you come out the opposite way of counsel.
And that's... is there anything more to add than what I stated earlier? No.
Okay.
Counsel, could I ask, what's the legislative history of this Act 86?
Well, that's a very fair question, and I can't speak entirely to legislative intent, but I can tell you all what's happened here since Nankin. I came to the city, back to the city 4 years ago, and at the time I was given a giant box of 7437 appeals that postdated Nankin. And also, you'll recall there was the U.S. Bank case where the city had some other arguments that perhaps Nankin didn't apply, and that was those were found not to be effective. And so once we got to the point where we needed to start actually trying 7437 cases in the city, where we have, again, thousands of tax appeals. You know, when I was city attorney in Brookfield, we never got past the second donut at the Board of Review. You know, excuse me, we'd have two appeals a year maybe. In Milwaukee, it's a little different. And so we had a lot of volume. A lot of 7437, a lot of very expensive commercial cases that if the city was in fact wrong in terms of the valuation, huge budgetary impact. You watch them arguing about $200 parking allowances on our web channel, and you'll see every dollar counts in this day and age. And these things cost money. Got to hire expert witnesses, you've got to prepare your case completely for the Board of Review, then you got to repeat it again in the Circuit Court, then maybe you have an appeal. And we said, wait a minute, going back to what I said earlier, is there some kind of a fair process we can come up with? We understand what people in the petitioner's shoes have as a concern. Their concern is getting railroaded by boards of review that are homers for the assessor. Okay? And, I mean, that's reality. Can we come up with something that's fair to both sides? This was the answer that we gave to the legislature.
Let me cut right to the chase. Did the city of Milwaukee have a hand in drafting this legislation?
The city suggested this legislation, Your Honor. The city was not the primary drafter. We did have an opportunity at some point, our legislative aides up here, the people who we have an office up here, did review it. And this was something that we decided we could live with. I think the other thing that in response to your earlier question that I would also state is there was some reticence on the part of the legislature at the time to completely repeal 7437, and for the reason I stated a moment ago. There are sometimes border review is going to need a kick, and maybe you need to have that club out there. But now you've got something that does almost the same thing, does it in a little more efficient fashion, and that's what we were looking for.
Now, your opposing counsel has suggested, let me say this. The legislation, as I understand it, and the chief has alluded to this, is an invitation to every one of the taxing jurisdictions in the state to buy into the new legislation and do away with de novo review in the circuit court.
If they give the taxpayer the legislative trade-off of a quicker hearing, that they get the 60-day period to get ready and get in there, yes. Okay. Yes, there is a trade-off in there.
And basically what your opposing counsel is saying is that if that were the case, the two cases that reached this court from Madison might have been decided differently. What's your response to that?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
What your opposing counsel is saying is the two cases that reached this court recently, the Walgreens case and the Adams Outdoor Advertising, would have perhaps been decided differently because of a completely different record.
I don't know that that's true or not true because I haven't looked at the complete record in either of those cases. But I think that the concern that this court expressed in Nankin about a record being incomplete or somewhat not getting everything into the record in front of the Board of Review and then the reviewing court being stuck with a bad record has been ameliorated by the legislative change that allows the circuit court judge his own motion or upon the motion of the taxpayer to say, well, wait a minute, they got horsed around on there. I want to see that. And it also goes, it raises another question that I just want to briefly respond to that Mr. Gordon raised about the importance of expert testimony. At some point, if a circuit judge were to believe that, boy, it's really important for me to see these people, I can make a decision well, and he or she has the right to bring them in, I believe. And certainly I'm sure there are going to be cases where counsel for the petitioner is going to be making that motion saying, you need to see these guys. Wait a minute, they were really going at it at the Board of Review, and you won't be able to make head or tails of it unless you actually have them here. So with that protection, it goes back to what I said was the motivation. It keeps the citizens from feeling that they've left the Board of Review and not been able to make that complete record. So in that case, if this applied, maybe it's a long answer to your question, sir, but I think ultimately the legislature has given the protection of the taxpayer so that they can make it right at that second tier.
Let me ask, in let's say the Walgreens case that came up from Madison, what were we looking at? We were looking at the circuit court record, were we not?
Well, it's a 7437 case. You had a record from the circuit court.
Okay. Now,
it was not a case under the enhanced, the new
let us say you prevail here today. And we have a tax case under the new procedure. What is it we're going to be looking at?
I think exactly the same thing. I think each side has the right to put the core of these cases, particularly the commercial ones, is going to be that appraisal report. I mean, these cases most of the time come down to two documents, their report, our report. You match them up, and they follow Most of the time, if they're done right, they follow the three-tier methodology with which you are all very familiar. And that's the key to the case. Now, at some point, somebody's going to say, that doesn't make any sense there.
But isn't Mr. Gordon arguing that the circuit court has to follow the Board of Review record, perhaps with supplementary material?
No, the statute says 13 and 16, the two statutes, the one applying to other municipalities, 16 is for cities of the first class, says the case shall be decided without regard to the decision of the Board of Review, and the record is what comes to them from the board, and if there are errors, now they can be corrected. That's a huge change from old certiorari. That's why I termed it in the brief enhanced, because it really is enhanced. It's way different, to tie it back to what a taxpayer has gotten for the last 160 years in our state.
What does it mean that something was unavailable before the Board of Review?
Unavailable refers to sometimes you might have a sale of a comparable property that you have the board hearing, you end up in court 6 months later, and as we know under your law, you can always use an ex post facto sale if it's reasonably close in time. And so sometimes there might be a truly probative property that when the board sat down in May, the property sold in June, now you're in the circuit court in September. That's fair game. So that was the intent behind that.
Let's suppose I'm trying a case before the Board of Review, and I have some material, but I don't present it to them. Is that material unavailable to the Board of Review?
I would think it would be the petitioner's obligation to present it. I would say that, you know, if you had a situation, and these processes are not used by individual taxpayers, but to give the example, if you had an individual taxpayer who appeared before the board and for whatever reason was cowed into not presenting something and then goes out and hires counsel for an appeal and counsel says, well, why didn't you present this? I'm going to make a motion to present it. Yeah, I mean, you make the argument. I mean, we trust our judges to exercise their discretion appropriately. It should get on the record, sure. So it gives some leeway. It's not certiorari. It's not you're stuck with it. And that's the old rule. It's gone.
Is there anything you would change in Judge Fine's decision?
I'd like to delete that last footnote, maybe, in regard to the jury trial. You know, we did, it was our...
Other than
it was out there because it was in that other case. Everybody knew it was out there, and so we threw something in, and Court of Appeals decided not to deal with it. Maybe you've decided differently. Hopefully, I've given you enough information to
other
at least get a start
that,
on
is
it.
Is there any change you'd make? Does he make any errors?
Not that I can see it. Again, the critical part being that burden of proof, which is what really flips the traditional cert action into a circuit judge becoming a new trier of fact, and thereby the taxpayer getting an unbiased view, or at least review of the evidence.
What's the standard of review if we're reviewing a board's decision versus we're reviewing a trial at the circuit court? Does it change at all?
Well, it depends on, is it okay?
May answer,
thank
please.
You. I think it depends on the type of action. The traditional certiorari action is the four elements. When they get up there now, in the non certiorari setting, a 7437 goes up there, that's where you get into this, the absence of this very high burden that a petitioner has to overcome in a reviewing court. Because it's again, the rule in cert actions has always been pretty much tie goes to the government, no matter what kind of a cert action it is or what level of government. Here now, It's everybody, the evidence is on the level upon a fairly minimal showing to the circuit judge. The circuit judge can render his or her own decision on the matter.
But when we take a look at it, does it change at all our standard of review if there's a full trial below versus, you know, a fresh new trial a certiorari
modified? That same carries through to this court. If it were to get here, you have far more leeway on, I believe, both questions of law and questions of fact under the new statute than you did under the old certiorari process, yes.
So we don't owe any deference?
Under the new process, no, I don't believe so.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you all.
Mr. Gordon, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Abrahamson. Let me try to pick up, if I can, on Justice Prosser's colloquy with Mr. Moschella on the point I'd raised at the very end with the Chief Justice's graciousness when the red light was on, focusing on the Walgreen and Adams cases. First of all, on the unavailability question. I think what clearly that would not allow is a new expert, so that if you're in a situation where you're in front of a board of review, you've got short notice, you're told you have a half an hour or an hour for a hearing, you hire appraiser at X level. When you get to this next level, unavailable certainly doesn't mean, and I think I would be, if it were against the city, I think I would get strong resistance from this city or any other if I tried to bring a new appraiser in under the standard, because the appraiser, I could say the appraiser was unavailable because I didn't hire him, but I don't think that would get very far. So that's a significant difference, even with that, with 7437 and the Board of Review procedure, is that I can't come in as I can under 7437 and get a new set of appraisers, because that unavailable thing is sure not going to let me do that. Now, focusing on Walgreens and Adams again, and your comments, Justice Prosser, on the record, which I had alluded to at the end of my main case, the Adams case took 3 trial days to try before a very experienced Dean County judge. The Walgreen case took most of 2 days to try from another very experienced Madison judge. This court knows what those records were like. This court knows how complex the testimony was. And I would ask the court, without a red light on this time, but following up on what Justice Prosser said, to just consider how different those cases would have been coming up here when they got to this court, if instead of those clean records, the case has been tried with no gatekeeper and nothing but a board of review with no judge giving them any guidance. If that's with all of that complex testimony that came in those cases, what that would have looked like to this court. And I think more germane to our issue is how less fair would it have been to the taxpayers who did pursue successful appeals to this court from unfavorable results in the trial court in both of those cases, if this court did not have the benefit of those clean records. And once again, I ask you, hypothesize taxpayers like Walgreens and Adams coming in a board of review situation, what those records would have looked like, and how fair can you say that it was to them? The complex cases are the ones we're talking about. Mr. Michelle's example of the simple case where there's one appraisal on each side, the judge takes the appraisal home and doesn't even listen to the witnesses, that may be the case in the small cases. But the cases where it makes the most sense to consider the difference are the two that came up in very complex records to this court, which were Walgreens and Adams. And I think that's something I would like to leave the court with is what would those cases have looked like even under these new procedures?
What would the jury instructions have looked like in Walgreens? Maybe that's not a fair question. But that gets back to my jury instruction concern.
Yeah.
Your argument, counsel, suggested to me that, you know, these were complex cases with very experienced judges, the kinds of cases that you would expect and hope to be tried to the court.
I think there were 2 levels, Justice Bradley. There would be the level of, there's the pure value, I mean, there's 2 issues in these cases. There's the pure valuation issue and the legal issues. Obviously, those cases would not have bubbled all the way up here and generated very lengthy decisions from this court if there had not been legal issues on top of just pure value. So there's 2 issues. I think on the valuation part of Walgreen, there would have been the standard jury instructions on valuation. I think we cited them in our brief.
I apologize, I'm interrupting you.
No, it's fine.
We're on short time, and I really have something a bit more pressing.
That's fine.
And that is a question I asked to your opposing counsel. What am I to do on this darned issue of the right to a jury trial? Because I do not know whether or not there is a constitutional right to a jury trial.
And in fairness, we did not brief it beyond the small snippet,
Do
we do it in Ankin, whether the court wants, as Justice Ziegler suggested, additional briefing, so we really get into that.
You're the one that's here as the petitioner.
No.
What do you want us to do?
I would think that if the court is, you know, thinks that may well be, and I think your comments and some of your colleagues' comments have suggested that is, you know, may well be the significant cutoff point. I think maybe, you know, I would welcome the opportunity to brief the issue further. I would, certainly would, because we have not obviously briefed it here, and I have not argued it more than a few comments in our brief. So we would welcome, if the court feels that significant, we would welcome additional briefing if the court would think that appropriate.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you for your arguments in property assessment, the second of the day. And so ends 09AP524 Metropolitan Associates versus City of Milwaukee. And thanks to both counsel for arguments and briefs. If the court wishes any further discussion on the jury issue, you will be advised by an order. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 for additional oral arguments, and we'll meet in closed conference at 3:10. We are in recess.